Sound effect producer Jennifer Wing and I meet Loreen Nussbaum in the lobby of a retirement home in North Seattle.
This is Gabriel.
Hi, Loreen.
I'm Loreen.
Loreen is a petite woman. She's 92 years old, and she insists on helping us with our gear.
Can I carry something?
Oh, I'm good.
Well, but just give me your coat.
Oh, sure. You can take my coat, yes.
And with that, Loreen glides up an enormous spiral staircase carrying Jennifer's coat.
I love these steps.
The fact that Loreen is here at all is pretty incredible. Loreen grew up in a Jewish family in Germany and later Nazi-occupied Amsterdam during World War II. The vast majority of people who fit that description did not survive. But Loreen did, in part because of the very laws the Nazis used to decide who was worthy of extermination. There were lots of fuzzy cases, mixed families, conversions. Somebody had to make the call when there were these cases of so-called doubtful ancestry. In the Netherlands, that someone was a German bureaucrat named Hans Kallmayr. He is the reason that Loreen and, by extension, we are meeting here today. She wrote a book about him in her 90s called Shedding Our Stars, the story of Hans Kallmayr and how he saved thousands of families like mine.
He just did not believe any of the anti-Jewish propaganda.
But before we get deeper into that, we head into her tidy mid-century modern apartment. She brings out an old photo album and flips through black and white pictures. One shows Loreen and her childhood sweetheart, Rudy Nussbaum, in a doorway on the day of their wedding.
Beautiful. You guys are such a gorgeous couple. Wow.
People came out and Otto Falk is standing behind the pane here. He was our best man at a wedding.
That's the Otto Frank, the father of Anne, whose writings were later published as Anne Frank, The Diary of a Young Girl. Loreen's parents, Marianne and Joseph Klein, were friends with Otto Frank and his wife Edith. Both families fled Germany for the Netherlands, which was neutral at the time, and settled in the same neighborhood. Loreen got to know the Franks' daughters, Margot and Anne. Loreen looked up to Margot, who was 2 years older.
She was ladylike. She was composed. I thought, wouldn't it be nice to be a lady like her?
Loreen remembers Anne, who was a bit younger than her, as a very chatty kid, usually surrounded by friends and known for having a lot of opinions.
In fact, one of her friends once said, the good Lord knows everything, but Anne knows it better.
What no one knew at the beginning was that the fates of these two families would go in two completely different directions, one toward doom and the other toward salvation. Loreen says at the beginning of the war, before people knew about the horrors at places like Treblinka and Auschwitz, life was bearable. She went to school and studied foreign languages. She rode her bike everywhere and soon got to know a handsome older boy named Rudy. He would visit the Kleins and play piano.
We had a cellist, a very dear man, who played the cello, and then my sister and or I would play the violin. Rudy would play the piano, or my mother would play the piano. So Haydn trios, some Mozart trios.
After the Germans invaded the Netherlands in May of 1940, life for Jews began to change. More and more restrictions appeared. Jews couldn't go to regular schools. They could only shop at certain hours. By the summer of 1942, Jews in Amsterdam were banned from public transportation, even from riding bicycles.
Eventually, all of us had to hand over our bicycles, so we had to walk.
To mark Jews as separate from the rest of society, they had to wear a yellow star every time they went out of their homes.
Yes, the yellow star, I think it hails from the Middle Ages to mark Jews as being not really part of the society.
The anti-Jewish actions escalated until, periodically, green vans would appear at each end of the block, like bookends. Nazi officers and Dutch Nazi police would swarm the neighborhood and round up anyone they suspected of being Jewish.
They would come to knock at each door and ask whether there were any Jews or look at you and ask for your papers and round up the Jews in the building. That was door by door.
How close did those get to you?
Well, they got into our apartment on August the 6th of 1942 and rounded up my mother and my sisters and myself. My father wasn't home, mercifully.
As they were held, Loreen's mother lodged a protest. She told the Nazis that she had an appeal pending before Hans Kallmayr, that bureaucrat who was deciding the tricky cases of who was and wasn't a Jew, the Germans sent them home to wait for a decision.
So we were let go because our case was on the Kallmeyer list and was a pending case.
Word was, Kallmeyer was quietly sympathetic to the Jews' plight. The trick was to have convincing paperwork, even if it was bogus. He didn't take bribes, and he wasn't swayed by tears. But if the paperwork was at least plausible, he'd give the person the benefit of the doubt. For Lorene's family, their hopes rested on her great-grandmother, her late Jewish, prejudiced great-grandmother.
If my mother's Jewish grandmother had not been such a hopeless bigot, we would not be alive.
Here's how it happened. Lorene's grandfather fell in love and wanted to marry, but the woman he loved was Catholic, and that infuriated his mother.
Not over my dead body will you marry a non-Jewish woman.
Lorene's grandfather abided by his mother's wishes. He lived with his non-Jewish partner and then had a daughter who was Lorene's mother, but they did not get married, not for 20 years, until his mother had died. And this, in retrospect, was the loophole that Lorene's family needed. It gave Hans Kallmeyer, the German lawyer, enough ammo to say Lorene's grandfather could have been a Gentile.
Kallmeyer, I have it in his writing, said, well, the mother of this woman was clearly not Jewish. Who am I to say that the father was Jewish? My office cannot ferret this out. So this woman, my mother, is not Jewish, period.
So your mother was declared non-Jewish by the Hans Kallmeyer office for dubious cases.
Yeah.
And it was okay that your father was Jewish in this case because there was a thing about privileged mixed marriages, right? So was that the ticket for you then?
Sure. It happened in January of 1943, and my mother and my sisters and I could take off our stars. That's why I call the book Shedding Our Stars, because we shed them like a reptile sheds a skin, you know. And my father was then covered by being married to a non-Jewish wife with half-Jewish children.
This scenario played out again and again. A Jewish family would go to Kallmeyer with just enough reasonable doubt, and he'd find in their favor. When there wasn't enough evidence to declare someone non-Jewish, at least in a way that would stand up to scrutiny, he'd often stall the process long enough for people to escape. As the Kleins were shedding their stars, as she puts it, like reptiles shed their skin, Lorene's childhood sweetheart had gone into hiding in a farmhouse out in the country. Being classified as a non-Jew allowed Lorene to help him.
I always knew where he was. I was his liaison. I mean, in a way, he depended on me for anything that had to do with the outside world.
Lorene brought Rudy books and food. Sometimes he'd sneak back into Amsterdam in the dark to visit Lorene and her family. In secret, they'd again take up their instruments and play chamber music. Meanwhile, by winter of 1943, the Kleins were suffering along with most of occupied Amsterdam. They had no electricity, no heat, and barely anything to eat.
Well, at the low point, we had no more than 200 calories a day, and a normal person needs 2,000, so you can see that we were literally starving.
They ate the beets that farmers raised to feed pigs.
They are very sweet, but they are by far more tasty than tulip bulbs. Tulip bulbs are bitter, they are awful, so we ate those too.
How do you prepare tulip bulbs?
Well, what could we do? We boiled them in water. We didn't have any butter or anything else.
The Franks, of course, went into hiding at some point, too. What do you remember about how that unfolded?
Well, that's a question I have been asked so often, and it always tickles me. You ask it more carefully. People say, what did you think when the Franks suddenly disappeared? I thought absolutely nothing, because everybody else disappeared. Why should I think particularly of the Franks? It always shows me that however much I talk, people can't get themselves into the situation. You go to school, and all of a sudden, the girl who was next to you isn't there anymore. And you knew better than to ask. You could be tortured in order to give somebody away. So we didn't ask questions. We were much too wise for that.
What Lorene would find out later is that the Frank family had been discovered, rounded up, and sent to concentration camps. Anne Frank would die there early the next year. So would Margot, who Lorene admired for being so ladylike, and their mother Edith. Only Otto Frank survived. The two families' fates went in opposite directions, and the point where they diverged was that decision from the German bureaucrat Hans Kallmayr. Lorene's boyfriend Rudy also survived the war. Lorene and Rudy had three children and ended up settling in Portland. They both joined the faculty at Portland State University. Lorene taught languages and literature, and Rudy was a professor of physics. Lorene didn't fully understand her family's survival story and the role that Hans Kallmayr played until decades after the war. And here's what she discovered. Kallmayr wasn't indifferent to the Nazi laws against Jews. He actively and secretly opposed them. He never joined the Nazi party and was an avowed socialist. He hired a Jewish secretary and clashed regularly with the Nazi brass. A doctor once refused to treat his son because Kallmayr was a, quote, Jew lover. But he was a meticulous lawyer, careful enough to cover his tracks and work within the law, even a monstrous law.
Kallmayr played it as carefully as he could, and he denied some people, and they were actually after the war. There still are Dutch people who think that he could have and should have saved more people, but he couldn't save them all. It would have been too transparent. As it was, he was already known as the Jews Kallmayr and so on. If the war had lasted just a little longer, he would have found out.
What do you feel when you think about Hans Kallmayr at this point?
Unfortunately, it's all very relevant again because we live in such a dismal period, historical period. Neo-fascism is on the rise, and it's anti-Semitism, it's anti-Islam, and it's horrible. And if there's one thing that I'm sadly have to take to my grave is that we, my generation, who were so sure that what happened to us should never happen again, and tried, apparently didn't try hard enough. At least we didn't get anywhere. I think things are much worse now than they have been in a long, long time.
So do you think of Kallmayr as an example for people who want to do the right thing in a very difficult circumstance now?
I want people to take away that, like Hans Kallmayr, you should always take responsibility and help and do good as much as you can wherever you are in life. I think that's the important message really for me.
That's Lorene Nussbaum, age 92. She's the author of the book Shedding Our Stars, the story of Hans Kallmayr and how he saved thousands of families like mine. Lorene and Rudy were married for 64 years until he died in 2011. After the war, Hans Kallmayr was briefly jailed for suspicion of war crimes. He was eventually released and lived out his years quietly. He died in 1972. Historians would later figure that Kallmayr saved between 3 and 4,000 Jews. That's several times more than the much better known Oskar Schindler. 20 years later, Yad Vashem, Israel's official Holocaust memorial, recognized Kallmayr with the posthumous title, Righteous Among the Nations.